Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the former Chief of Police of Seattle for an analysis of both the behavior of the police in Ferguson, Missouri, and the St. Louis Metropolitan Police, who just released cell phone videos confiscated from bystanders of the fatal shooting of a mentally disturbed young African-American man who taunted the police to shoot him. Norm Stamper, who is an advisory board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition and author of Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing, joins us to discuss the criminalization of the mentally ill in America, as well as the criminalization of drug abusers, neither of whom Chief Stamper feels should be in jail, but instead should be dealt with by medical professionals, not law enforcement officers. Then we'll look into the record settlement of $16.65 billion between the Justice Department and Bank of America with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizen, who formerly served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We will discuss how much money B of A paid out compared to how much they made off selling toxic mortgages, and the likely fate of Angelo Mozzillo of Countrywide Savings, who at one time was responsible for about one-third of the liar's loans that ruined the lives of millions of aspiring homeowners, most of whom, unlike Wall Street bankers, have not been made whole. Then finally, we will speak with Elias Grohl, and assistant editor at Foreign Policy, where he just wrote the article, U.S. Special Forces Tried and Failed to Rescue James Foley. We will examine what is known about the rescue attempt, which was apparently based on human intelligence, and what is known about the London-accented British member of ISIS who issued a statement before executing James Foley and is believed to be one of three British members of ISIS nicknamed John, Paul, and Ringo, who are believed to be the jailers of Foley and other journalists being held hostage. And joining us now is Norm Stamper, who's a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs. His latest book is Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norm Stamper.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And, of course, we've seen enough of the dark side of American policing in terms of the lack of transparency coming from the Ferguson Police Department. And that's in contrast to the St. Louis Police Department, or the Metropolitan Police Department, who released cell phone footage on Wednesday of a police shooting of Kajimi Powell. That is, of course, we don't know what evidence the Ferguson police people have, but they've certainly not apparently been particularly cooperative. I think twice the Attorney General on one occasion asked them not to release the footage from the convenience store of the victim, Michael Powell, grabbing some cigars. And then subsequently, I believe Attorney General Holder called them up and said, get those damn tanks off the streets. So is there a jurisdictional turf battle going on here between local, county, state, and federal police in Ferguson, Missouri?
Oh, to be sure. You know, one of the interesting phenomena of American law enforcement is we have federal, state, and local, and by local I mean both city and county law enforcement jurisdictions. There are 18,000 police departments in this country, and that can often complicate relationships and jurisdictional boundaries under the best of times, and certainly during crises.
So what is your sense then? I don't know whether you've seen the video from the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department of the shooting of this African-American 25-year-old man who was killed on Tuesday. I looked at it, and my sense, Norm, is that we've got to find a better way to deal with mentally ill people on the streets. Look what just happened here in Los Angeles with the higher patrolman beating this woman whose own family say she's mentally ill. It looks as if the L.A. District Attorney is going to put forth charges in that case. And then again, you've got the incident of the mass shooting recently in Santa Barbara, where the police went to visit this young man and they found him to be okay, And he, in his own private writing, said he was greatly relieved that they didn't come in and search because he had the guns that would have incriminated him and perhaps prevented that massacre. But the point I'm trying to make here, Norm, is that you can't expect police to be psychiatrists, can you?
No, you can't. And in fact, one of the biggest responsibilities, I think, of police officers is to call in mental health experts in situations where they can. That means there has to be a capability, an existing structural capability for providing that kind of assistance, and there has to be training and sensitivity on the part of the officers so that they know when to do that. I believe that we have, in what's commonly called the Memphis model, a very smart approach to teaching police officers over the course of an intensive full week. That doesn't sound like very much time, but given what we historically have devoted to training police officers and how to handle mentally ill people, it's a giant step forward. It's a class that is taught by mental health experts who have very practical wisdom about what to do and what not to do in handling mentally ill people. Very often the police do exactly the wrong thing when trying, you know, with the best of intentions, in some cases certainly, trying to bring under control someone who is acting in some dangerous or otherwise risky fashion.
But when you have an incident like this one in St. Louis where the victim in this case was taunting the police, or in fact, if not begging them to shoot him, this is what's called suicide by cop. Surely there's got to be levels below the idea that you shoot 12 rounds into this man who they claim was waving a knife and closing in on them, although the video is extremely ambiguous about that. Why not tase him, for example?
Police officers in this country have been taught that if someone is approaching you, gets within 21 feet with a so-called edged weapon, that might be a knife, it might be a baseball bat, they can get to you and assault you, perhaps even kill you, before you can take your gun out of its holster and pull its trigger. They've been taught this, and they've been taught it in officer survival training. What I wish we could say with some degree of confidence is that they've also had their discretion reinforced. It is certainly true, a lot of people doubt this, but we've simulated it in San Diego over and over when I was a police officer in that city for 28 years. It's certainly true that the so-called kill zone is a real thing. But we sometimes fail to really inform our police officers that the discretion to fire or not fire is yours, and how you exercise that discretion is critical. You don't want to take reckless risks with your safety or the safety of any other innocent people. But at the same time, you can very likely save a life if you really have an understanding of the dynamics of mental illness and the limits of your own authority and your own discretion. And I think we do less than a stellar job in helping police officers make those kinds of decisions.
Again, I'm speaking with Norm Stamper, who's a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs. His latest book is Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. But just having seen this video, I mean, this guy is so clearly, I mean, in fact, the voiceover from the guys in the neighborhood taking to the cell phone video are all saying, you know, before the police arrived, they're sort of taunting him, saying, you know, you're really screwed up, man, you know. I mean, it was pretty clear. And, you know, we've all, here in Los Angeles, of course, Santa Monica is jokingly referred to as the home of the homeless, and you walk down right. The streets and, you know, you're always confronting people who are manifestly mentally ill. So I think it's a deeper societal problem that we're dumping people on the streets. But on the other hand, my sense is that mentally ill people it's pretty clear that they are, you know, screwed up. I'm trying to think of a more polite way, that they're troubled.
They are troubled. Their reasoning capabilities are diminished, and that's why it's incumbent on communities to develop a comprehensive and very intelligent approach to dealing with mental illness. The answer is not jail. Putting a mentally ill or drug addicted individual behind bars is cruel. It's inhumane. It may give us a moment, just a moment's satisfaction that our safety has been enhanced by that, but it does nothing to accomplish what really needs to be accomplished, and that is a comprehensive, preferably nationwide response to mental illness in this country. As you say, dumping them on the streets is not the answer. Putting them behind bars is not the answer. It does mean providing help for them, treatment for them. And we do know that the overwhelming majority of mentally ill people are not a danger to themselves or to others. They themselves often are victims of assaults, sexual as well as other physical assaults, a function or a result, really, of their condition. So if we have, if we can put our heads and our hearts together and really go to work on developing a much better societal response to mental illness in this country, we'd all be safer, our communities would be healthier.
So, Norm Stamper, since you retired Seattle police chief and you were the chief of police at the time of the so-called Battle of Seattle, I take it that after that incident that you had sort of second thoughts about the extent to which the kind of militarized presence of tear gas, dogs, and armored vehicles on the streets might well have caused more problems than they solved. So could you walk us through that experience and that change of heart that you had?
Sure. By way of background, I have been throughout most of my career deeply committed to the proposition that the police belong to the people, that policing is the public's business, and that if we want to be a people's police, we have got to restructure law enforcement, demilitarize law enforcement. And yet, despite those deep-held convictions, I made the biggest mistake of my 34-year police career on the streets of Seattle during the WTO conference, during that battle in Seattle. And let me tell you what I did. I authorized the use of hard gear, so-called hard gear, which is ballistic helmets and face shields and basically head-to-toe protection. Always committed to officer safety. I have no trouble arguing for and securing the best safety equipment we can for our police officers, along with training, to make them as safe as possible. But one of the things that I forgot, and I guess that's the most charitable way that I could define it for myself, is that I forgot that the appearance of a militarized police force it actually jeopardizes the safety of everyone, including the police officers. Now, add to that the one singular act that was the biggest mistake of my career, and that is using tear gas against nonviolent, non-threatening protesters designed to provoke, designed really to escalate and not de-escalate tension. I will regret to the grave that I authorized that decision. In fact, I was 5 years into my retirement with nothing to gain or lose by taking one position or another, that it finally dawned on me that I had made a huge mistake. See, it was the cop in me that said, well, we need to have this intersection cleared. This is a disaster waiting to happen. And what I'm describing really is nonviolent, non-threatening demonstrators who sat down at an intersection on 6th Avenue and in downtown Seattle and locked arms. There wasn't, a square inch of asphalt visible. They completely clogged that intersection. The cop in me is saying, well, in support of my operations commander and my field commander, we do need to clear this intersection. We have other contingents of demonstrators who are converging on the scene. We would not be able to get an aid car an ambulance, police car, a fire engine through that intersection had there been some kind of medical emergency, for example. And so it was the cop in me that blessed that decision. It was the chief in me who should have vetoed it. But it wasn't until after hearing on book tour from a lot of people who were on the streets of Seattle during that time, coming from really different parts of the globe, and saying, you know, I was very proud of, very impressed by your police department on day one. On day two, that respect, that trust, that confidence in the police dissolved as a result of my actions. So I think I say this not to beat myself up. I say it because I think other law enforcement agencies need to learn that lesson. And it appears that they're ignoring it. And I'm distressed over that. I think it's not fair to the officers, and it's certainly not fair to the community.
And I imagine seeing what's going on in Ferguson on television for the last, 13 days with all the tear gas being lobbed and those big tanks and snipers and stuff like that, it must have brought it all back.
It did bring it all back. You know, I've dealt with that issue. I've finally gotten honest with myself and recognized that only by acknowledging these mistakes can we prevent them in the future. But when I see, for example, police officers looking like soldiers, armed with military equipment and weaponry, and using military tactics for crowd control, I'm just stunned that in Ferguson and as we saw with the Occupy movement, many other law enforcement agencies repeating the same mistakes that I made in Seattle in 1999. There was one additional scene from Ferguson that harkens back to a very ugly chapter in American history. And you mentioned it a moment ago, and I'm talking now about the use of police dogs. There was one scene of a white police officer holding a leash. At the end of that leash, a lunging, snarling German Shepherd police dog. I'm a dog lover, by the way, but you don't use police dogs for crowd control. That was supposed to have gone out after the era of Bull Connor in Birmingham, Alabama, sicking police dogs on nonviolent, non-threatening civil rights demonstrators. It's a sickening sight. It really haunted me when I saw that.
So Chief Norm Stamper, again, a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs. His latest book is Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Expose of the Dark Side of American Policing. It's very clear in Ferguson that there is an us and them mentality, and there is, of course, the tremendous disparity of 53 members of the I think of all the 53 members of the Ferguson police force, I think only two or three are black. But this us and them mentality, which I believe is a problem. When you said you were on your book tour, I guess you were crossing that line between us and them and hearing back from citizens. Is that a problem? Do police tend to live in communities where other police are? Do they not interact enough with the rest of the community to get a feeling for, you know, just to get feedback?
It's a huge problem, Ian. If you think about it for a moment, if the police in this country do in fact belong to the people, they have to be a part of that community, not apart from it. And yet their equipment, their training, the culture of policing all kind of conspire to create a gap, a real gulf between police officers and the citizens they've been hired to serve. And that happens, can happen in every single city, regardless of racial composition or other demographic considerations. But where it happens in a community that historically has been neglected or oppressed by their local law enforcement agency, the problems are, for obvious reasons, only exacerbated. The underlying mistrust, the tension that exists on a day-by-day basis, not just for years, but literally for decades, makes it all but predictable that when there is a controversial police shooting, for example, all hell will break loose. I believe that that is, in fact, what's happened in Ferguson. You're right. 53 cops, 50 white cops, the rest African-American. So what we've got is a situation where if you live in an impoverished community where racial segregation and discrimination are an everyday reality, where the schools have failed, where unemployment is through the roof, you've got a tinderbox. You've got a situation that is combustible. And the explosion that we saw 10, 12 days ago in Ferguson was, I think, absolutely predictable. Now, police are not sociologists. They're not psychologists. They're certainly not psychiatrists. Police are not social workers by definition, although much of their work has that flavor to it. But they are peacekeepers. And as such, if they're carefully selected, if they're well-trained, if they possess the kind of maturity and self-confidence and self-discipline necessary to get that job done and get it done well, then they can, in fact, ameliorate a great deal of that underlying tension caused by these other social factors. At a minimum, they can bring dignity and respect to the relationship that they cultivate with the communities they've been hired to serve. They belong to the people, not the other way around.
Well, just in closing, Norm Stamper, we talked earlier about the criminalization of mental illness in this country and the extent to which there is an inadequate social response to the number of mentally ill people that have essentially been dumped on the streets and how putting them in jail is counterproductive and counterintuitive. I take it, though, that since you work and you're on the board of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs, that that same critique applies to the war on drugs. In other words, instead of criminalizing the drug problem, we should medicalize it.
We absolutely should do that. And of course, that is not even foreseeable absent a new model. A public health model, and certainly a medical response to those who have a dependency or an addiction, and are in many cases asking for help and not getting it. I think we need to come to grips with the fact that the drug war has caused far more harm than good. We have literally spent well over $1 trillion prosecuting the drug war. We have incarcerated, no exaggeration, tens of millions of Americans for low-level, nonviolent drug offenses since Richard Nixon back in 1971 famously proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and then declared all-out war on them. Make no mistake, he was declaring war on his own people, and particularly young people and poor people and people of color. And then we wonder why there's such a strain in the relationship between young people, poor people, people of color, and their local police. We have made of the police an enemy of the people. We are incarcerating literally major segments of communities across this country. And then we wonder why there's a quote, a breakup of the African-American or Latino nuclear family, that sort of thing. Well, we need, I think, to put a mirror up to ourselves and ask ourselves, what are we doing as a society? What are we doing as a government to perpetuate this problem? And the drug war is as far as I'm concerned, is at the top of the list. The drug war has fractured families. It has resulted in death and injury. It has decimated local treasuries. It has filled prison cells, oftentimes privately run prison cells, which I think is just unconscionable. In other words, they're building and filling jail cells with the idea of profiting. And that's just plain wrong. That should never have found its way into the criminal justice system of this country.
Well, Norm Stamper, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Norm Stamper, who's a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a group of law enforcement officials opposed to the war on drugs. His latest book is Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Expose of the Dark Side of American Policing. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the record settlement of $16.65 billion between the Justice Department and Bank of America.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
And on Thursday, the Justice Department announced that the Bank of America has agreed to pay a record $16.65 billion fine for selling these toxic mortgages and often called liar's loans during the build-up to the 2008 crash. This, of course, Bart, is the largest settlement between the U.S. government and a private corporation in American history. So in itself, I suppose that means something, right?
Yeah, and certainly Public Citizen welcomes this more muscular approach to this settlement. Records are always nice when it comes to Wall Street fraud. We remain concerned that it is a pale shadow of the really grim problem that has beset America through this massive macroeconomic fraud of mortgage making and selling of securities.
And this follows the November settlement from J.P. Morgan Chase. They agreed to pay $13 billion. And in July, Citigroup agreed to pay $7 billion. But this seems to be a pattern, doesn't it? Nobody goes to jail, but a lot of, you know, guilt money, albeit
yes,
a fraction of what is owed, goes to the Treasury, some of which goes back, by the way. I believe in this B of A agreement, $7 billion goes back to some of the distressed borrowers, right?
That's right. To deconstruct the $16.6 billion, $5 billion is a fine. That's just a check that Bank of America has to write and goes to the Treasury. Of course, that check doesn't come from the managers who committed the fraud. It doesn't come from heaven. It comes essentially from shareholders who, not incidentally, had nothing to do with this fraud. Another $5 billion are checks cut to about a half a dozen states who invested in the mortgage-backed securities. And another $7 billion or so isn't really cash. It is supposed to be relief for consumers who have Bank of America loans but whose homes are worth less than what the mortgage is.
But still, we need to remind ourselves that the Bank of America sold nearly $1 trillion worth of mortgages, of which more than $200 billion were defective. And the main source, of course, was the Countrywide Savings. They also, of course, B of A also owned Merrill Lynch. So I take it that there is finally going to be a move against Angelo Mozilla, the former head of Countrywide Savings.
Yes, there are reports that there is a civil case pending against Mozilla. As we all know, he was the head of Countrywide. at one point had come close to originating almost 30% of all the mortgages in the United States, and that was his goal at any cost. And the cost, of course, we now continue to pay for with this Great Recession, or digging ourselves out of this Great Recession. When we talk about whether or not this $16 billion settlement is fair, let's look at those two numbers you mentioned. $1 trillion worth of mortgages packaged and sold as mortgage-backed securities, $200 billion of those were defective. If you take any percentage of $200 billion, you know, if a home mortgage is $250,000 on a home that's truly only worth $150,000, let's say that would be roughly 30%, or even take 10% of $200 billion, you're getting a figure that is larger than the $5 billion or $7 billion in mortgage relief. So in other words, even this figure of $7 billion is not going to make whole the consumers who bought these mortgages or took out these loans from Countrywide, nor is it in $1 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities is the $7 billion that is being sent to various pension funds in various states going to make them whole, nor the other people that bought this $1 trillion. So we're dealing with two orders of magnitude, one, the harm, and two, the penalty, and unfortunately, they're not connected. And I only make these guesstimates, I'm forced to make these guesstimates, because none of that is described in the 50 pages of documents. What was the gain that Bank of America made from the sale of these securities? How is it connected to the penalty? The bottom line is it may well have still been a good deal, that this fine was just the cost of doing business.
Well, it's pretty hard to understand why it's taken so long. And PBS's Frontline did a very good expose of the Justice Department's feckless guy, Lenny Brewer, who was supposed to be in charge of prosecution. He ended up working for a Wall Street law firm that defends these big banks. It looks like since his absence, something has happened. But what I find extraordinary about this whole financial meltdown, particularly when Countrywide Financial was really at the heart of it, and Bank of America, of course, acquired Countrywide in mid-2008. There was an executive with Countrywide who was on 60 Minutes a few years back talking about how they all knew inside that this was a racket, and they tried to blow the whistle on it, and nobody would listen, and nobody at B of A would listen. And what I find extraordinary, Bart, is that we're talking about the world's biggest paper trail. I mean, everything's on paper. It's not like the evidence is hard to find here. So why did it take so long?
And to further vent, if you will, if you'll allow me, even when you read the Justice Department's documents, they recite emails which are essentially effective admissions of fraud. We have to cover this up because that will be a problem, because this is certainly illegal and we don't want anybody to find that. There it is. Well, who wrote that email? Why is that person not facing a prosecutor at the other end in a courtroom? And there is a 10-year statute of limitations on crimes that involve banks. So it's not even that the statute has run out. So to attempt to answer the question, and I don't have an answer, just some theories, is, as you pointed out on Frontline, there's a misunderstanding of how the law works. Lanny Brewer, Judge Jed Rakoff of New York Court, said as much. There is the theory that these deals are easier to do than an actual prosecution, that there was an early attempt at Bear Stearns officials that failed. The jury acquitted them, although one of the jurors wrote a note saying, you know, bring us more such cases. This one, there was some technical problems with it. There is this worry that there's a cost-benefit analysis, and the Justice Department says, well, we might lose. Well, in my opinion, go ahead, take some losses. If you're not losing now and then in the courtroom, it means you're not trying, and clearly they don't seem to be trying.
Again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who is the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. So what's your sense then going forward here, Bart Naylor, of the impact of this, given that it seems to be the preferred route of the Justice Department to get settlements? And as you pointed out, we don't know what the ratio of the payout that Bank of America was forced to pay, the $16.65 billion, how that relates to how much money they made. That still is opaque, right?
That's right. Well, the problem is if all of this is supposed to remediate Wall Street, if it's supposed to send the fear of God or cause them to be honest, I don't think that it does. And I think, tellingly, if you look at the official statement from Bank of America, presumably it was edited or at least reviewed by the Justice Department itself, there is no expression of contrition by Bank of America. They talk about how this will be a 43 cent charge per share. They talk about how this will put the matter behind them. But they should say this will be a marker for the future. We will put this settlement on the billboards of every break room to make sure that no Bank of America person engages in such activity in the future. That's what it should be for Bank of America or any other company on Wall Street, but it's not.
And what do we know about the money, the lobbying money that Bank of America has spent on Capitol Hill? We know that through the banking lobby, which I'm absolutely certain Bank of America contribute to, the banking lobby, loosely speaking, the Wall Street lobby, have spent a fortune, and they have fought tooth and nail to water down the Dodd-Frank Act, to hold it up. They held up the appointment of the new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They tried to kill that. Mostly the Republicans are working hand in glove with them, but there's a lot of key Democrats, and particularly Democrats who represent minority communities, have been essentially bought off by the banking lobby. It's an outrage, to my mind, that these guys say that, you know, everything's going to be hunky-dory going forward. And every day they're trying to block the reforms that came after the 2008 crash, which many people think are inadequate in any case. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. I mean, if you're trying to stop the government from preventing the next meltdown, then you haven't learned a goddamn thing.
That's right. And as you say, I should check Bank of America's numbers, but the Wall Street writ large lobby spends $1.5 million a day lobbying. That's not addressing the amount of money that they contribute to congressional candidates, sitting members of the House Financial Services and Senate Banking Committee. We FOIA'd the records, the agencies that dealt with the HSBC case. That was one of the first big settlements where the Justice Department acknowledged that they didn't bring tougher enforcement because, in short, the bank was too big to jail. And we have found that there clearly is coordination, as there should be, between the various agencies to figure out whether, in fact, they could terminate the bank's charter or bring a stiffer penalty. But one has to also worry that Treasury is an agency of the White House. We know that getting elected to office costs money, and Democrats need it as badly as Republicans, and Wall Street has been a generous source for Democrats as well. So one has to wonder if politics plays a role in judicial enforcement, especially in these cases, J.P. Morgan, Citicorp, Bank of America, where no court gets to see just how justice has come to its, how the prosecutors have come to their decision. This is a deal, and that's the problem. It's a deal between Moynihan of the Bank of America and Eric Holder of the Justice Department, and how they work it out. There is no, as it should be, court, judge or jury that overlooks this and decides whether or not, in fact, it's fair.
Now, didn't Holder, before he became the Attorney General, didn't he work for a Wall Street law firm?
That's right. Covington and Burling, which is across the street and two blocks down for the Justice Department, and people keep wondering. They notice that some of the offices are being repainted, that he'll be returning there, as did Lanny Brewer, same law firm, but that it's rumored that Holder will be going back there in 2015.
So what's then, we've talked over the years about, since the 2008 crash, about how Wall Street has been made whole and Main Street still languishes, and there's been this $7 billion drop in the bucket that came out of this Bank of America set for the settlement for the distressed borrowers, but there's a hell of a lot more of them out there, millions of people living in their cars. The tragic thing about the 2008 meltdown and these liars loans and this deliberate, and it was deliberate, there's no question that they knew what they were doing, fleecing these people. The people they fleeced were people aspiring to a better life, to the American dream, often minorities and veterans trying to buy homes and move up in the world and getting conned into this situation and ripped off, and then they end up with nothing. I mean, it's just terribly cruel to me to think that this took place and that these guys back on Wall Street are fatter and happier than ever.
That's right. And apparently the reward system is such that such behavior is welcomed. So, for example, in the year that J.P. Morgan paid what was in aggregate a record amount of fines over the course of the Bernie Madoff and their mortgage fraud and some other issues, it's almost it becomes a blur. They paid $20 billion. Well, the board of directors looked at the CEO who caused this, who oversaw these settlements, and said, "Well, good job. You've reduced our liability better than we could have thought. We will double your salary." So it seems to me the message given to him is not the right one. He, you know, there should have been a demotion, some pain that the most accountable person at that bank should have suffered. And in fact, he got a raise. This was a time of, I guess, celebration for Bank or for J.P. Morgan.
Well, just in closing, then, what's your sense then of what citizens should do to counteract this massive banking lobby?
Well, citizenship, as we say, is a daily responsibility. So I deal a good deal with Congress, where that $1.5 million in lobbying spent by Wall Street gets a lot of. A lot of juice in Congress, and what we hope is that members, public citizens, both generically and those who are actual members, will continue to call, write, email their congresspersons when votes come up and tell them that financial policy is important, that we don't just wait till the first Tuesday, the first Monday of November to weigh in.
Well, Bartlett Naylor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the failed U.S. Special Forces rescue attempt of James Foley. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elias Grohl, who's assistant editor at Foreign Policy, where he just wrote the article, U.S. Special Forces Tried and Failed to Rescue James Foley. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elias Grohl.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the Pentagon gave this briefing, and I take it you tried to get as much information as you could out of the Pentagon. But let's begin with, didn't the press have wind of this when it happened back in the summer? And there was an agreement not to publish because of fear that this could result in the death of hostages or retaliation against them. And that because of the video of the execution of James Foley, I believe it was the Washington Post that was prepared to go public, and the White House preempted them by announcing, which is not a lot of information, right? I take it that's, but what we learn is what was announced in response to the fact that the Washington Post was going to go public.
Exactly. Basically, what seems to have happened here is that the Washington Post had this story very shortly after the raid occurred in Syria, and the White House, as it sometimes does, convinces a prominent newspaper to sit on a story for various reasons. And in this case, the Washington Post decided to move forward with the story after the video came out. It seems as if the agreement that the Post had with the White House was that if something happened, that perhaps then they would be able to go forward with the story when the video came out showing James Foley's execution and beheading. They proceeded to do so, and then the White House decided to preempt them and conducted this briefing with a group of select reporters. It seems to be from the New York Times and the Washington Post in order to break this news that, in fact, the raid had taken place.
So what did we learn about the raid? That it was elite troops. Apparently they killed a number of militants, and one of the pilots involved in the operation was injured, apparently by fire from the ground. Was he in an aircraft? Because my understanding is that they weren't just helicopters involved, and they also had what they call a CAP, a combat air patrol, over the top. That's in itself a fairly significant thing, that the United States flew into Syrian airspace. Presumably, the Syrians were aware of it and, for whatever reasons, weren't able to do much about it. Is that your understanding?
Well, who knows if the Syrian government was aware of it. If this operation was carried out where James Foley is believed to have been held captive, it would have been somewhere in Raqqa province. And that's essentially no-go territory for the Syrian army at this point. So, you know, their ability to monitor their airspace is very much an open question. So the Syrian government may not have known about this operation until it was revealed this week. There have been interesting comments from Syrian militants in the aftermath of this revelation that they might not have been aware of what the purpose of the raid was. There was an offhand comment that one ISIS source made to a McClatchy reporter saying that, well, these American commandos showed up to our base and carried out this raid, and then all of a sudden they left, and we really don't understand why they were there in the first place. Raising the question as to whether or not ISIS ever even knew that the United States had tried to carry out this rescue operation, that they were in fact confused about why these commandos had showed up all of a sudden.
But in your article, Elias Grohl, in Foreign Policy, U.S. Special Forces Tried and Failed to Rescue James Foley, you said that the operation was based mostly on human intelligence. Would that be, I mean, I assume that some of the intelligence came from Nicolas Henin, a French reporter who was freed in April, and also another French journalist, Didier Francois, both of whom shared a cell or whatever they were in with James Foley, who they, on French television, they've been describing as an extraordinary journalist. Would they have provided intelligence? Because apparently the fellow that at least is this, the suspect who executed James Foley on television, whose nickname is John, was a part of the detail that jailed him, these three British jihadists who the prisoners referred to as John, Paul, and Ringo. And John is the one that apparently is the executioner in this videotape. And the British, of course, are looking for him or looking for details about him. Do you think that these French captives who were freed, obviously paid a huge ransom, are the source of some of this intelligence?
I'm sure that their comments played a role in informing this operation. It would be almost unthinkable that they didn't. When we talk about, or when U.S. officials anyway, talk about human intelligence of this nature, I would imagine that it probably goes beyond the French journalists. I don't think that they would be willing to carry out an operation of this nature, which is extremely risky, and if it goes poorly, is a political catastrophe for the White House, only on the statements of captive journalists who all but certainly were being held in a different place than where this raid was being carried out. Or if it is the same place, it would be extremely surprising. You know, why would ISIS not have moved these prisoners to a different location once these journalists have been freed who knew about that place? It would be just terrible security procedures. So I imagine that it goes much deeper than that. I think that's certainly the subtext of a statement from a U.S. defense official saying that this is based mostly on human intelligence. But it's difficult to know. We don't know more than that. They haven't told us more than that.
Again, I'm speaking with Elias Grohl, who's an editorial assistant at Foreign Policy, where he just wrote the article, U.S. Special Forces Tried and Failed to Rescue James Foley. Well, it does seem, though, that the French journalists are perhaps the source for what we know about John Paul and Ringo, and in particular John, who is this London-accented British member of ISIS who made the statement before proceeding to behead James Foley. The British are looking high and low for him. Was there any mention of these people in these Pentagon briefings?
I'm not sure. We haven't heard a lot about the specific captors so far from the U.S. officials that this story was based on. More or less everything that we know about them, at least that I've seen, has been published in the British media, coming out in The Guardian, and they're reporting based on captives who were being held alongside James Foley. So unfortunately, I don't have too much to add on that point.
But what we know about the actual operation itself, the Special Forces operation, according to your article, Elias, it was the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, which is an elite group known as the Night Stalkers.
That's right. And these are very elite aviators. They fly all kinds of planes, both helicopters and other types of vehicles. They are primarily known for their work with the Army Delta Force and the U.S. Navy SEALs. They're essentially the pilots that take these commandos into the hairy situations in which they do their work. But they're a very well-known group, and you might describe them as kind of legends within the special operations community and those who write about them.
So what did you learn then about how many people were involved on the U.S. side and how many militants they ran into and killed?
U.S. officials are only saying that there were a large number of fighters that were killed in this operation. They say that several dozens of commandos were involved in it. Beyond that, they're not really willing to say, but by the sound of it, it seems like a quite comprehensive operation. As you mentioned earlier, there were both fixed wing and helicopters involved in this operation. There were combat air patrols above. We know that there were surveillance aircraft involved. U.S. officials have said that virtually every branch of the U.S. military was involved in this operation. So that speaks to a large rather than a small operation, certainly. But it's difficult to get beyond any more specificity than that. U.S. officials, when speaking about these operations more generally, are, and it's rare that they do, and it's in that sense surprising that we're even talking about this operation, that we even know that it took place. They're loath to reveal sources and methods in how these kinds of operations are conducted. So it's a lot of what we're talking about here is certainly inference as opposed to specifics.
Well, we learned from the editor of Global Post, who were the employers of James Foley at the time that he was abducted, that the ransom that was demanded was 100 million euros, but it was sort of so absurd that nobody took it seriously. There's also reports that the assumption always was from the Global Post in their negotiations to try and get him out that Foley was being held by an elite part of the Assad regime's Air Force intelligence, who have their own prison. And as you know, the Assad ruling clan come out of the Syrian Air Force. Was there any mention at the Pentagon briefing about the possibility, as has been reported by Michael Kelly and others, that it looks as if Assad may have handed this Foley and Stephen Sotloff over to ISIS?
I haven't seen any U.S. officials get behind that theory. in the discussions of the failed rescue mission. I think I would look at those reports quite skeptically. The ones that I've seen on that front, they've been, largely speculative, it seems. And there hasn't really been a clear rationale that's been presented as to why the Assad regime would find it in their interest to hand over someone like this. The nature of his capture was – of James Foley's capture, that is, was always very unclear. We know very little about it. We only know that he was seized by a group of armed men. Their identities have always been quite unclear. I believe he was seized in territory that was under control of rebels, I believe in Aleppo in November of 2012. So how he would have at that point made it into government custody seems very unclear. It seems like he was certainly operating more in rebel, or that is working in rebel-controlled territory as opposed to government-controlled territory. So I would look at those theories that the Assad government was James Foley's original captor somewhat skeptically.
But in terms of Stephen Sotloff and others, do we know how many people they were trying to get at the time of the rescue, and those that are left behind, and given that some of the French hostages were government paid, and the French government has a different attitude than the United States government has? And of course, we know that the excuse, for what it's worth, for executing James Foley was in retaliation to U.S. bombing of the Islamic State forces in Iraq. So what's the sense of who's left behind?
Well, we know that there are other Americans that were the target of this raid, that there were other American hostages that were supposed to have been freed in this raid had it been successful. Now, the identities of these individuals are being very closely held. The policy of most media organizations in the past has been not to discuss the fact that they have been taken hostage. And while the number of hostages has been known, that number remains very closely held. And there have been statements by U.S. officials that have tried to discourage disseminating any more details about how many hostages ISIS still holds. The thinking is that by disseminating more information about them, they become more valuable, and thus it becomes more difficult to gain their freedom. And that's a line of thinking that I'm inclined to respect and don't particularly want to offer more information about the number of hostages that are being held. But certainly, the information that has been circulated very widely and very publicly is that there were other Americans being held with James Foley and that were the target of this raid. More than that, I'd be very hesitant to say.
Well, of course, Stephen Sotloff was put on display as the next in line to be executed. So at least we know about him in the grimmest possible fashion. I thank you for joining us, Elias Grohl.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Elias Grohl, who's assistant editor at Foreign Policy, where he just wrote the article, U.S. Special Forces Tried and Failed to Rescue James Foley. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side to sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.